Good morning. So, last time we finished up talking about bitwise operators. We talked a bit about parallelism in bitwise operators. We observed that a lot of our bitwise operators actually perform lots of operations at once, and we can take advantage of that, even though maybe the more natural way of thinking about a problem might be to think about doing one thing at a time. You want to get maximum efficiency out of these bitwise operators and to do multiple things at once, which is what sort of happens all the time when we're just doing hardware design, is that we try to figure out how to do multiple things at the same time, because that's something that hardware is really good at. Then we talked about the difference between an instruction set and a microarchitecture. We mentioned that the instruction set was the software interface, and despite the name maybe not directly implying that, that includes things like the machine code. It's everything we need to make some set of software work on a machine, and if we change what software works on one machine to another, that has a different instruction set. If we don't change that, but we change the implementation nevertheless, we've changed the microarchitecture. And we can have different microarchitectures that implement the same instruction set. Because we have different design goals, you know, different sophistications. So one example is that, like, we might have a different microarchitecture if we're targeting really high performance versus if we're targeting really low power. There just might be different hardware designs we want, even if we're implementing the same instructions, the same machine code, and so on. We mentioned one big split in instruction set design was this RISC versus CISC idea. So RISC was this reduced instruction set, CISC was this complex instruction set, and there was this sort of evolution in the 70s, 80s, 90s, where originally instruction sets were kind of designed more with the assembly programmer in mind, and people figured out how to implement machines that could implement all sorts of really convenient instructions for assembly programmers, where the hardware would do lots of stuff for you. And then people moved away from that and had this other idea that, well, you know, we have things like compilers. You know, it's easier to change software than it is to change hardware. So let's focus on having the hardware do what it does best most efficiently. But let's expose to things like compilers the most efficient versions of the operations they need, and let them figure out how to make programs with that rather than making things necessarily more convenient. So we ended up doing things like saying, well, it's going to be easier in the hardware if our instructions have fixed length, even though that means that, like, encoding a constant in an instruction is now going to be more awkward because, you know, if we want our instructions to be, say, 32 bits, well, you can't put a 32-bit constant in there. You're out of room already. And that's inconvenient if you're coding assembly, but if you're writing a compiler, you can deal with that pretty simply. And other decisions like that, like let's not have x86's complex way of specifying memory locations. That's a lot of work to implement in hardware. We can deal with it pretty easily in the compiler. So they made these decisions which were about, you know, exposing what the hardware does well to the compiler and in a fast way, making the hardware implementation simpler and giving the hardware people more time to not only speed up the instructions they have, but also maybe give more of other resources like registers to the compiler. And before I move on, so one note on the quiz, it looks like I made a off-by-one error in my key. So I will look over that very carefully after this, rather than trying to correct it hastily before class and making another mistake. So, and do something about that. Other questions? Or questions on things we covered last time? So today we're going to look at the instruction set that our textbook proposes, as which is a subset of x86-64, and it's one we're going to implement. And as you look through this, you'll see that our textbook authors chose to agree with some of the ideas that the RISC design philosophy people had, but not all of them, in simplifying 64-bit x86. So the instruction set we're going to implement omits most of the instructions in x86 and leaves just these. We're going to talk about some of these especially. You know that some of them I marked as renamed. Some of these you probably haven't seen, but are going to come. So I'm going to start by talking about maybe the simplest, well, not the simplest, but not this probably the simplest instruction here, but the simplest instruction that something interesting needs to happen to, which is move. Doesn't do much. But you know that I've marked it as renamed. So our textbook authors decided that rather than having one move instruction, we'll have several different versions of it with different names. And the names are going to be a letter representing the source type and the destination type, and then move Q. And also something that is a little subtle here is that all our instructions are these Q postfix. So if you remember when we said talked about AT&T syntax, that means they're 64 bits. So we're just not going to support 32-bit, 16-bit versions. If you want to do that, too bad. But since we're implementing hardware, that's probably more convenient for us. We don't have to worry about like dividing things up into bytes and things like that. And so for our move instruction divided into these pieces, we're going to move 64 bits from an immediate. So immediate is a name for a constant. That's what that means. So it means a register or someplace, some value that's in memory. So there are, if you do the enumeration, there seem to be 9 possibilities. Three for the first letter, 3 for the second letter. Some of them don't make sense. Like, we can't move a value from a constant to another constant. Constants don't change. Can't move value from a register to a constant. Constants don't change. So on. So moving values into constants doesn't work. And there's 2 moves that we could implement that our textbook authors decided to omit. So one is moving from a constant to memory, and another is moving from memory to memory. So as you may recall from 2150, you were probably told that moving from memory to memory is not an instruction in x86, which mostly it isn't. There's an instruction which does that, but it's not move in x86. But we're not going to have that at all in any form, and we're also not going to have constant to memory move. So you might say, what if I want to move a constant into memory? How do I do that? Well, you move a constant into a register and then move from the register into memory. That's what you're going to have to do. So it's not like we've omitted that functionality. We've just, decided to lower the number of instructions we implement because that's not a very common thing to do. So the instructions we're left with are immediate to register move, register to register move, memory to register move, and register to memory move. And every time we write these out in assembly for YD6, we're going to write out these names, we're not going to write move. And we'll see later why our textbook authors probably wanted to have this renaming happen. So questions on these variations on move. Okay, so there's some instructions here I mentioned that you probably haven't really seen before. So one is this thing, cmove, and I have this italic cc. So I have jcc, which is conditional jumps. So cc is like less than, greater than, and so on. But there's this cmove, so this is conditional move. So this is an instruction that exists on x86-64, but you probably didn't see very much. And in x86-64, it might be a complete move. In YD664, it's going to be register to register only. And it's basically equivalent to, so if condition, then move. Do a move, and the condition would be like less than, greater than, and so just your normal conditions you'd have for jumps. So in our example here, C move G, conditional move if greater than. This is move if greater than. Is like a jump if less than over the move, and then a move. But in one instruction. And we have more, there's obviously also a move if less than, and a whole bunch of other variants. We'll see the full list of what we're going to be supporting later. Questions on this conditional move instruction? Yes?
Do you move if it's greater than what again?
So the question, what's the comparison? If we're checking the condition codes the same way that jump if less than would. So these are going to be based on the condition codes. Yes? So the question is, are we comparing RAX and RBX? No. So the assumption in both of these cases is that there's some compare or something like that up here, and it's actually not a compare because you may have noticed that's not on our list of instructions. But something here that, so something sets SF and ZF, and that's the assumption in both cases. And that's what it's going to be based on. This instruction uses the results that are set in SF and ZF. It doesn't actually do any comparison itself. And something that might help remember that is that it wouldn't be very useful to have an instruction that both compares its operands and moves if the comparison goes one way. We probably want those to be separate things. And that's in fact what they are because we have condition codes. Other questions? Yes. So this would be omitting two instructions and adding one more in. It's omitting one instruction because the JLE is the only added instruction here. Yes. As we'll learn when we talk about processor implementation, in many processor designs, implementing conditional jumps is actually not very efficient. And that might be the motivation why you'd want to add this conditional move instruction to an instruction set. Other questions? Yeah.
What happens if you try to move a constant to a register?
What happens if I try to conditional move a constant to a register?
Yes.
That is not an instruction that exists. It won't assemble. When we look at the machine code format, you'll see that there's just no way of representing that. Other questions? Okay, so another instruction that was on that list was HALT, H-L-T. So there's an x86-64 instruction called HALT, H-L-T for HALT. In y86-64, we rename it to HALT with an A, which seems to make more sense. This is an instruction that basically stops the processor, so it's probably a little more subtle about what stopping the processor means in a real system. What we'll be implementing, we have a simulator, it stops the simulator. So we want an instruction to do that, that's why we have it. It's reserved for the OS, so you've probably never seen it in a normal x86-64 program. Okay. So, we now know what all these instructions are, because I think you've probably seen the other instructions before. Knowing that the jumps are like jump less than and so on. Let's go over some ways in which these instructions are a bit simpler than what x86-64 supports. So let's look at our register to memory move. So we have a value in R11 that gets moved to memory at the memory location computed by adding the value in R12 and 10. So this is valid, but we are not going to support all of the other ways that x86-64 lets you specify addresses. We are going to support doing just R12 in parentheses, but that's just because, you know, it's as if we wrote zero, and that's in fact how we'll encode it in the machine code. But all the other options we're just not going to support. That's a more risk-like decision. We're not having the processor implement all this stuff. And another thing about accessing memory is that the move instruction I showed you is going to be the only instruction that lets us specify a memory address like this. We're not going to allow it for any of the other memory instructions. So for example, the add instruction can only take two registers in Y86, unlike x86-64. So let's say I have this add instruction that's in x86-64, and I want to do it in Y86. So which of these options will simulate that? If you come to look over them. And these options are overriding R11. You can assume that that's allowed, even though, yes, like, you know, if something else was using R11, it would be a problem. Who needs more time? Okay, three people. Okay, who still needs more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D? Okay, so D is the correct answer. So C would be the answer for something that goes the other way around. But remember that in AT&T syntax, the destination is last. So questions? Not this. Yeah?
You do the register memory move, but instead of using the base index scale, using the base index, you just pass the memory address.
So the question is, could you pass just an address MR move Q like 10 to somewhere?
Or the other way around, register memory move and the register address.
Or vice versa. We're gonna assume that you have to specify a base register to keep things simpler. We actually do have a kind of way of getting the absolute address stuff to work, but it's kind of by accident. Like, the design is basically there's a base register. And we'll see when we have the assembly format why we're doing that. And sorry, the machine code format, why we're doing that. Question back there? So the question is the problem with the invalid line that you can only add stuff to registers or something else? So it's, yes, is that we're only going to allow adding with registers. So when we look at the machine code, we're just not going to have a way of representing in the machine code adding to a memory location. Other questions? Okay, so that gives us our answer. Okay, so we saw accessing memory. For accessing constants, works the same for constants, works the same way. IRemoveQ is the only instruction with a non-address constant operand. So what I mean non-address, so like jump and call have a constant operand, which is the function to call or the label to jump to, but that's an address, right, to go to. IRemoveQ is the only place where you have just a normal constant. So that means if you want to, for example, add one to a number, that is not a legal instruction in Y86. We're not going to have a way of encoding that in machine code. So instead, you're going to have to do something like move one to a register and then add one. And if you look at all these restrictions we're placing on what operands we can take, the thing which happens is that we end up with only one kind of value is allowed for every operand of every instruction. That if we have an MRMoveQ, the first thing needs to be displacement base, and the second needs to be a register. There's no other options. If we have an add, it needs to be a register and a register. There's no other options. And this explains why we split up MoveQ. So this holds true. And this means that the instruction name like tells us everything else about what information we need to run it, what the format of that's going to be. We know exactly when we see the name. And that's going to mean our machine code is going to basically be saying, here's something that tells you what the instruction name is. Now you know where the rest of the information for the instruction is because you know what type of information that is. There's no multiple options to choose from. And this is a choice our textbook authors made to keep things simple. Okay. So some review of some instructions you should know, but that are worth talking about. Push and pop. So we're going to actually need to implement these, so it's kind of important to know, for example, you know, are we accessing memory at the location before or after the increment or decrement? And the answer is for push. We decrement and access memory at the decremented location. That's what the semantics of it are. And for pop, we access memory at the stack pointer's location and then increment it. And it's by 8 because we're pushing and popping 8 bytes. I'll note that I'm writing this down as if we do the decrement first and then we access memory. But as far as what the hardware does, you know, we just need to have that effect. We need to access memory at that location and set RSP by the time the instruction finishes. We can do that, and we in fact will do that, in a way where we don't actually write RSP, you know, before we access memory necessarily. We don't need to do that. We just need to make sure the values we use to access memory and to write to RSP are correct. So questions on push and pop? Yes. So the question is, what's the relevance of the order? So if I have, let's say my initial RSP is X, this means that if my initial RSP is X, that then the, so if X is the initial RSP, then RBX better be memory at X minus 8, and the new RSP better be x minus 8. And the order is relevant because if I swap the order of these statements, you'd assume that I have to access memory at x, not x minus 8. Or sorry, RBX better be assigned to memory at x minus 8. Does that answer your question? So the order here is about whether we're using the value after the arithmetic to RSP or not. That's very important. So we'll get different values, and we have to be consistent with what we specify. So we have push and pop. We have two other instructions which are very much like push and pop, which are call and return. So call does a push, except rather than pushing a value from a register, it pushes the program counter, the next instruction address, onto the stack. Return pops an address on the stack from the stack and jumps there. Questions? Yeah.
Could there be a way to implement those instructions using push and pop?
The question is, could I do this using push and pop, like if I was compiling without having a call and return? Mostly, it gets a little complicated because of return. Because it only takes one type of operand, takes a constant label rather than a register value. But other than that, yes. Other questions? Okay, so we have our instructions. We also have state we need to track in our processor. So we kind of imply there's some memory. We also have registers, and we have 15 registers. You might say, wait a moment, where we lost one, and we did. So our textbook authors chose, for the convenience of hardware design, to omit R15. Also, you notice that we don't have EAX and so on. We don't have instructions that operate on less than 64 bits, so we don't have those sub-registers. We have condition codes. So we have the zero flag, the sign flag, and our textbook has the overflow flag. We're not going to implement the overflow flag to keep things simpler for you. There's no compare instruction. It was on the list. You're going to say, so how do we compare things? You can subtract. It still sets the condition codes. We have this value we'll call stat. So we're going to be running in a simulator. Our simulator needs to know whether to keep going or not. Stat is some state which is telling the simulator, do we keep going? Are we finished or not? And also we'll indicate error conditions we should report, like, did we finish because we halted normally or because of an invalid instruction? We have a program counter, sometimes called the instruction pointer, which tells us where in memory are we retrieving machine code for an instruction. And of course, we have memory, which is going to contain both our code and any data we're operating on. Questions about state we're going to deal with? So before I move on to encoding, so we can observe, we think about our sort of risk design philosophy. There are some things that our textbook did by simplifying to x86, 64, to y86, which follow this philosophy in a lot of ways. We have separate instructions to access memory. We have these move instructions. Those are the only instructions mostly for getting data between registers and memory. Like our normal arithmetic instructions don't do that. We don't have any sort of looping instructions like x86 has. We learned about a more full version of x86. We don't have instructions that have two memory operands. We don't have many addressing modes. We have one type of operand for every instruction, even though we did some work to split up instructions to make that happen. There's some things we aren't doing that RISC-like systems do. We don't have fixed length instructions. We're going to have variable length instructions, as you'll see when we talk about the encoding next. And, well, we have fewer instructions, but these aren't actually all simple instructions in the way that typical RISC processors would do. So our push and pop and call and return instructions are actually pretty complicated, and they're probably more complicated than a typical RISC design would think was a good idea to implement. So like if you think of pop, pop is writing to two different registers at once. That's something that RISC designs would often try to avoid. So questions about how RISC-like or not our textbook author's decisions are. Yes?
So for pop, the two registers it would be writing to are the stack pointer and then whatever register is getting what's being popped.
So the question is, for pop, we're writing to the stack pointer and the operand? Yes. Other questions? Yeah. Can I explain what I mean by no loops and single instructions? So when we saw the VAX instructions, we saw some instructions that like did a loop, did like evaluating a polynomial, for example. Like that's like a loop. So we have no instructions that seem like they should take variable amounts of time. And the textbook authors deliberately did not keep any x86 instructions that did that, which there are a few of. Yes? Why is more registers a RISC-like decision? So when we are omitting ways to access memory easily, and also having less complexity for instructions, so first we want to make up for having less ways of accessing memory. So more registers helps with that, right? Because if we have separate instructions to access memory, we kind of want to make up for that for the compiler. And since we have less hardware, hopefully, to implement instructions, more registers is a way we can use that. So there's kind of different reasons why you want to do it. They tend to end up adding more registers. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about machine code. So YD664 machine code, as I mentioned, it's variable length. And here I've shown you the encoding where the instructions vary from 1 to 10 bytes. So I have bytes number 0 through 9. And I've divided some of the bytes up into two halves, which are the most significant 4 bits and the least significant 4 bits, which means that, for example, the NOP instruction has one byte, which is 0x10 in hexadecimal. And for some of these instructions, like halt, NOP, and return, well, we just read here and we have exactly what the encoding is because there's no operands. So a NOP instruction is always 10, a halt instruction is always 00 at single byte value. But for other instructions, we need to somehow say what kind of instruction it is specifically, like for conditional moves or conditional jumps, or as it turns out, arithmetic. Or we need to specify its operands, like what registers it's using or what values it's using. So let's go through those settings. So first, we have our conditional jumps and moves. And there's something happening here, which is a bit maybe not what you'd have guessed. So we encode register to register move and unconditional jump as just a special type of conditional move or conditional jump. So we have this least significant 4 bits are that first byte, specifying what type of condition it is, and one of the types is it's the always true condition. So that's an unconditional jump. The jump instruction is encoded with that, versus a jump less than just has a different number there. Yes?
So when you're encoding a register, register, move, it would always start with 20?
Question, so register, register, move always starts with the byte 20? Yes. And 2 followed by something else would be some other, some type of conditional move that, you know, isn't always true. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, conditional move only accepts 2 registers? Yes, that was one of the restrictions I mentioned briefly earlier. Other questions? So we also have this op queue listing, and op is a placeholder for some arithmetic operation, and we can specify add, subtract, and an XOR, and we specify that with sort of a secondary opcode, basically. So we have the opcode specifying what operation to do, the code for the operation, and we have a secondary part for the very similar arithmetic instructions. Questions on this? Okay, so then we have a bunch of instructions which take register operands. And what our textbook authors have done is that they've always put the register operands in the second byte of the instruction. And in some cases, instructions only have one register operand, which is either the first or the second, so they've used that slot of the second byte for that operand and left the other part unused. They mark the unused part with the hex F, or, you know, so all one in 4 bits. And they have this just fixed mapping from register number to, register number in the machine code to register name. And note that we made it R15, so R15 is a way of encoding no such register, which they decided to allow, even though that's probably not really necessary. But it's going to make some of the hardware implementation maybe a little easier. Questions on our registers? Yes? So the question is, for push and pop, do you need to write the F for the second place, or could you just not write it? So our instructions always need to start at the beginning of a byte, or else retrieving the instructions will become really awkward. Right? If we had in machine code where instructions could be half a byte, we need to have a program counter that could be half a byte. So we're not going to do that. So we need to have something there. And what our textbook authors have specified is that it needs to be F. Now, when you're actually implementing the instruction, probably you're not going to care about that. So probably you're going to allow some variation from the specification. When people make real processors, they're usually a little careful about allowing that sort of thing. And one reason why is that if you want to extend the instruction set in the future, if people are accidentally using things you don't allow, that's much harder to do, right? If you wanted to make putting something other than F do something in the future, that's hard to do if you silently allowed it to do nothing in the past. So what typical commercial processors will do is they'll try to make things like if you didn't put an F in that slot would cause your program to crash. Just to make sure that they have that flexibility later on if they want to change what the extra unused encodings. Okay. Other questions, follow-ups? Yeah. Question, are what are the numbers at the beginning? Okay, so the numbers at the beginning tell us which of which line we're in. So when we're trying to figure out what an instruction is, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at the most significant four bits of the first byte to see which line of this table to use. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? What's the green box? We'll get to that in a bit. Okay, so some instructions, besides having registers, take constants of some sort. So we have I remove Q, and R remove Q, and M remove Q all take this constant. In I remove Q's case, it's the value to move into the destination. In M remove Q and R remove Q's case, it's a value to use to compute an address. These are always 64-bit in x86, and sorry, in y86, and they're always in little endian. And that's what V and D are here. We also have similar constants for conditional jumps, unconditional jump, and call, which is the destination address. Just the address that we're going to go to. Again, in little endian. Questions? Yeah.
So what's the difference exactly between just regular D and
DES? The question is, what's the difference between regular D and DES? The names I'm using here are meant to match the names I'm using here. That's the only reason. And I just chose them because we call this a displacement, and I couldn't write out displacement in this space, and we call this a destination. But the bytes are going to be the same. That answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Can you jump to a function name?
Can I jump to a function name? So, yes. So, if we have assembly that jumps to a function name, remember that that function name is a label that represents an address. So, when we produce an executable for YD664, it's going to turn into an address in the machine code. So, we're going to be able to write assembly that uses function names because of that translation. Yes?
Can you go over again what the difference between V and D is?
The question is what the difference between V and D? So I call the thing that we move with I remove Q a value, and the thing that we move with, the thing we use to compute an address with R remove Q and M remove Q a displacement. That's the only reason for the different letters. Yeah? Question is, the only difference between jumping to a function name and calling, with calling you can also return? Yeah, in the sense that calling will set up the stack for a return. Yes, otherwise they have the same effect. Other questions? Yeah.
Why does the blue box...
why are these boxes I have highlighted so large? So these are 64-bit values, so 8 bytes. Yes, so they take up 8 bytes, which is, should be aligned with our numbering of bytes up here. So they are, in fact, yes, much bigger. Other questions? Yeah.
Just go over what the CC is for jump.
So the CC tells us what type of conditional move or conditional jump we have, or if it's not conditional at all, in which case it's the unconditional normal jump or normal register to register move. And you'll be able to refer to these tables. This is not something to memorize. Yeah?
So registers generally store 64 bits, right?
Yes. So the question is, how are we using half a byte to represent registers? We're just identifying which of the 15 registers, sorry, we're referring to. So it doesn't matter how big the registers are, it matters how many of them there are, how many bits we need to do that. So with 15 registers, 4 bits is enough to assign each of them a unique number. Yes?
So if we're making an executable the first, or like the memory address of the where the function starts?
So the question is, when we're making executable files and we're like filling in a jump, is that going to point to, or call, we should say, is that going to point to where the function starts? Yes, because that's the first instruction we want to run after the call. So that would be, in fact, the address that goes in that box labeled dest. Does that answer your question? Other questions? OK, so I've shown you this encoding. Our textbook authors provide a tool called YAS, so Y86 Assembler, which is basically an assembler plus linker for, it does both at the same time for this. So for example, if I have this Y86 assembly program in a file named example.ys, and I download the HCLRS toolkit that we'll use later, if you run the YAS tool after building that, you'll end up with a file like this with the extension.yo. Now, the extension.yo makes it sound like this is an object file, but really it's an executable. And one way we can see that is that we don't have anything like a relocation. We just filled in the address 1e that this jump greater than goes to. So this is the destination field of the jump greater than. Note that it's in little endian as a sequence of bytes, even though they're all written together. So it goes to address 1e, which is where the loop is. You also note that unlike a typical executable or object file, this .yo file is very human readable, which should be to your benefit so you can actually figure out what's going on without taking out your hex editor. Yes? So this is the, so question is, this is the executable object file? This is the executable. I wouldn't say, I guess, I will try to avoid calling things that are executables object files. And it's just confusing that our textbook authors call it .yo instead of .yexe or something like that. Yes? The object file that had this come before this would like have the 1e as zeros. So it may or may not, but it would definitely have some information about there's something to fill in here. That the tool our textbook authors does, basically it assumes your assembly program doesn't need to be linked with anything else. So it just does the whole, that assembly program to an executable without including any other assembly files. Process. Yeah. So question, is it executable, is it in binary? So if we were worried about efficiency, we would not want things written out as text like this. For what we're doing, we want to have a simulator that's easy for you to debug, so we write it out as text like this and have this extra comment information to help you figure out what's going on. So it's not, even though it is an executable, it's not written in binary, but if this were something a real OS, we'd hopefully have this stuff in binary just so it loads faster. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah?
Do you have to halt every program?
What?
Do you have to halt every program?
Question is, do you have to halt every program? So if you don't have an instruction like halt, the processor is going to access whatever's in memory after your program when it keeps going, or unless you like have a loop or something. So it's going to try to run something. Now, you may have noticed that the encoding of halt is two zeros. And it turns out that in our simulator, the default value of memory is zeros. So if you have your simulator keep going, you'll retrieve a halt instruction because that's just what's in empty memory. And that's probably exactly why our textbook authors chose to encode halt with zeros, which is not how x86 encodes something like halt. But zeros in x86 is like an add to memory instruction. Yeah?
To get back to like the previous slide, the reason why it's, the reason why it's jumping to 1e is because that part of the value is little endian, right?
The reason why this is 1e00 instead of 0001e is because it's little endian. If so, yes.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay, so let's practice some YAD664 encoding. So first of all, I have an add one function. I've written out an XA664. Tell me how to write it. Which of these is a way to write it in YAD6? Because we can't write, there's no move group instruction, so we at least have to change that. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks A is a correct translation? Okay, B? C? Okay, D? Okay. So I think C is the canonical translation I would give. So to do this, I didn't actually translate the assembly directly. I just said, oh, it would be easier to, I have to put one into a register somewhere to do the add, because I can only add two register values, so easier to use REX for that. D is also a more direct translation that's also valid. So I'm still doing the original move as intended, but I'm using RDI as a temporary register after that to hold one. And B is not correct because we don't put the return value in the correct register. Okay, so questions? Okay, so let's take our canonical simplest version and encode this. So the way I do this is I look at my table of encodings and I go to the line where I saw that instruction. So I look for the IRMOVEQ line and I look at my blank. So my IRMOVEQ line starts with 30, F and RB, which in this case, if I consider I had V comma RB, that's what was written in the table. And RB is whatever RAX is. And then I have to encode 1 as a little endian number. So here's the sequence of bytes starting with the lowest address byte that encodes 1 in little endian. Okay. So I do that, then I need to say, okay, I have this REX here. I don't actually want REX. I look up in the table what REX is, and I find out it's 0 in that table I showed you earlier of all the registers with a corresponding number. So that's my encoding for the first instruction. Then I do the second instruction. I look at the line of the table. It's the OPQ line. I have a fill in the blank for add versus subtract and so on. I'm going to look up in a table for that and for the two registers. So I, again, look up in those tables. What was add? I find out add was 0. I look up what RDI was, and I find out it was 7. And I look up what RAX was, and find out it was 0. And I get 6070 as the encoding. Then I have my last instruction return. I look it up in the table. I find out it's 90. There's nothing to fill in. I'm done. So this is my encoding. And I went to write it out as a sequence of bytes. So I'm going to write each byte's value in hexadecimal. And this is what I'll get just writing out the bytes I have produced. And I've highlighted the first, the most significant 4 bits of the first byte of each instruction, just so it's easier to figure out what's going on. But in the machine code we generate, that's not actually necessary. Like, it's just going to be a sequence of bytes. We're not going to have in the hardware some extra indicator. Questions about how I did this translation? Yes?
Why is 1 the most significant?
So the question is, why is 1 in the, what you said, the most significant part? So this is not written from most to least significant. This is written from, this is lowest address to highest address. In each byte, it's most to least significant, but otherwise it's not. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So we also have to encode other things. So let's look at an example of encoding where we have a jump. So here I start with an add RAX to RAX. So I look at the line of my table. I find out it's the up Q line. So a 6 followed by whatever the indicator for an add is. And then I have the register numbers that identify RAX twice based on the format there. So I fill that in and I get 6000. And then I have this jump if greater than. And I'm supposing here that this add instruction was located at address 123 in hexadecimal. So that means the jump instruction, I'm going to have the jump type, I'm going to have the number for greater than for my table, which is 5, and then I have to encode that address 123 as a little endian number, so the lowest address byte of that number is going to be 23, then 01, and so on. Yes?
Why do you have to specify the memory address of the instruction above for JGE?
So the question is, why am I specifying the memory address of the instruction above for JGE? So it's only the instruction above because that's what this label points to. So if that label pointed somewhere else, it would be a different address of a different instruction. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. Yes. The question is, there are always lots of zeros at the end. So not always, because we could have an address that's much bigger, but it's always 8 bytes. So typically, that means there's going to be a bunch of zeros because we're not using the full range of that 8 bytes. Other questions? Okay, so we have encoding. Let's talk about doing decoding. So here I have some machine code written out as a sequence of bytes, and I want you to decode it. So let's start with the first part. What are the types of the first 3 instructions? So can someone tell me, how would you go about figuring this out? Somebody tell me how to figure out the type of the first instruction. Yeah.
You look at the first number of the first byte.
Okay.
And because that's a 2, you
Okay, because I realize, oh, the most significant 4 bits, tell me which row I'm in, and that's the register, register, conditional move. Okay, so yeah, that's the type of first instruction is either a register, register, or conditional move. So how do I go from that to figuring out what the type of the second instruction is? Yeah, back there. Okay, so you're telling me I can skip over until the 6 zeros. How did you know how far to skip?
Because RR and the viewer, CC, both only take up 2 bytes.
Okay, so you said, oh, I looked at this first instruction and it's 2 bytes. So that means that I can look on my machine code and say, these are the 2 bytes that it's gonna that it's gonna take up. So the next instruction must start after that, and I look at that 6 to see where the next instruction starts. And I can repeat that process, so I look at this 6 instruction, I say, oh, this row on the table here, that's 1 2-byte, so that's going to be another 2 bytes for that. So that 2 bytes is that instruction, and the next instruction starts with 6-1, which is another example of that, and I can keep going. And then I have an instruction that starts with 7. So I look at the 7 row, that's this conditional or unconditional jump, some sort of jump, and that takes up 9 bytes, according to my table. Starts from 0, goes to 8. And so I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 bytes. So that's the conditional jump instruction, or the conditional or unconditional jump instruction. So questions on how I this process? So when I finish going through that, I can identify where all the instructions start, which I've just highlighted here. So then I can go through instruction by instruction and actually decode them. So I can start with my first instruction, which happens to be an R move Q. I look at the 2 line, I see, oh, there's a CC field, which is 0. I look up in the table what 0 is. It's always, meaning it's the unconditional version of that instruction. So it's R move Q, not some conditional move. I look up what RCX is, I find out that it's, sorry, what RA is, I find out it's RCX. I look up what the RB, the 0 is, I find out it's RAX. And I get that first instruction. And I repeat that process for all the future instructions. So for adds and subtracts, you know, I look up what they are, look up their registers, like so. And hopefully this is correct and I make an error on the slide. Then I have my conditional jump. So for my conditional jump, I have a 2 for the condition code in this case. So it's a jump less than and not some unconditional thing or something else. And I have an address, which is 840000. If I write that out, you know, as like I would in C, that's 0x84, where 0x, a bunch of zeros, 84, same number. So I've just written it out that way. If we wanted to translate this more fully to usable assembly, I'd probably want a label. And then I can keep going like so. Questions on how I did this decoding? Yes?
How did you know that it was R move Q rather than C move?
How did I know it's R move Q rather than C move Q? So when I look at this instruction, the least significant part of the first byte is the condition code value, the condition code indicator, right? Which it tells us what type of condition it is. And when I go to my table I showed you earlier, 0 is always. So, or meaning unconditional. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Is everyone comfortable enough that they could do this decoding with those tables? Hopefully. Or questions? Okay, so we've talked about instruction encoding, and our next topic is going to be building hardware to run these instructions. So we know how to decode the instructions by hand, but we're going to want to build hardware that decodes these instructions and runs them. And to talk about hardware, we need to talk about how we're going to describe hardware. And one way we could describe it is with pictures. So here's a picture of a counter. Talk about what all the things in this picture mean. And this is a valid way of building hardware. And in some classes, they might have you like build a processor with pictures, basically. There are tools, sometimes called schematic capture tools, for building hardware, designing hardware by drawing diagrams of circuits and the components and so on. They're even commercially supported tools. They're not commonly used for processors. Typically for processors, we instead use something that looks more like a traditional programming language. It's not that you couldn't use something more graphical that's closer to what we're maybe building. That's just not what we've typically settled on because of sort of how complex processors get. So we're going to have a text-based representation of a circuit. And it's going to be like a programming language in that we're going to abstract away a lot of details. We're going to extract away how did we do like all the arithmetic, right? We're just going to say we have an arithmetic component we're going to use. We're not going to, you know, rewrite how to do additions every time we need additions. We're just going to assume that that's like, kind of like a library given to us by the programming language. We're not going to worry about building like registers or memories from transistors. We're just going to say, I want a memory, I want a register. We're going to have one. Kind of like a library tool. We're not going to worry about building something we'll call Muxis, we'll talk about later. From gates, we're just going to say, we have this component called Muxis we can use. And we're also not going to talk about how we actually would implement these sorts of library functions of our hardware programming language in this class. So if you want to learn that, take a different class, like 20 through 30 or some ECE courses. We're just going to assume it's done for us by someone who knows what they're doing, hopefully. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the semester, we're going to use a tool called HCLRS, which is based on the textbook's hardware command language. Based on the textbook's language called HCL. I assume if you're making a processor, it has some differences, which is why I'm going to go over it in lecture, also because the textbook's description needs some going over in lecture, even if we were using the textbook's version. So to build circuits, we're going to have some abstractions we're going to talk about as their components, and one of them is going to be wires. So sort of in hardware, wires store, as far as we're concerned, a voltage. And we'll consider that a binary value, even though, yes, it's really a continuous voltage. And we'll say, like, you know, a high voltage is 1, low voltage is 0, or something, convention like that. And each wire holds, you know, 0 or 1. And if we want to represent a multi-bit value, we'll have a bunch of wires together, like are shown here. And wires will propagate values. So we'll put a value on a wire, we'll put a voltage on a wire, and the other end of the wire will have that after some small delay. That, you know, we'll worry about much later. Now, when we're describing circuits, usually we don't want to draw out or write out all the wires. Because, you know, here I'm showing a 5-bit value, but typically we're dealing with 64-bit values. And I don't want to draw 64 lines altogether on my diagrams. Now, I could draw this more compactly like so. And notice that when I'm representing this bundle of wires here, I'm just writing 26 in the end to represent that it holds the value 26. I'm not like writing the values of the individual bits. That will be very common. And writing out these sort of lines for each bit usually it's not something I'm going to want to do. So usually I'll just write out a thick line saying that's a sometimes shorthand call of the wires, a bundle of wires that holds, in this case, 26. And sometimes I might be careful and notate very explicitly how wide it is by drawing this slash on it and writing, in this case, a 5 for its 5 bits. And if it was 64 bits, I'd write 64. So questions about how I'm going to draw pictures of wires and bundles of wires? So we're going to kind of treat like a bundle of wires as our fundamental unit. And sometimes I will, for shorthand, just call it a wire, even though, yes, it's really like 64 wires or something like that. Okay. So we mentioned when we talk about bitwise operators that we kind of build the calculating parts of circuits from things like gates, like our AND and ORs and NOTs, that take in some values and produce a result based on some calculation. And we saw like the very simple calculations, AND, OR, and so on. But the same kind of circuitry can do more complicated calculations like additions. And we're going to kind of generalize that. And we're not going to be concerned about the details of how do you make a circuit which adds two numbers. We're just going to assume you can build that. So we're going to like draw a box which takes in some value and outputs some value that's a function of that. And I'll just label it to say what it's doing. So we have this thing which is presumably built from gates, which is where the output is a function of the input. After, in the hardware, like this would be something where we input some values in wires, and after some hopefully short delay, we get, you know, the result of some calculation based on those inputs. So questions about this idea, these circuits that calculate things? Oh, and I guess an important thing to note is that the result could be a different width than our output. We could have, you know, like 64 bits going in and say 2 bits going out or something like that. Like our input could be like the result of a calculation, the output could be SF and ZF. And that's fine. Okay. Questions about this? Okay, so I've shown you sort of pictures of circuits. We're also going to be using our programming language. So let's show you how these things look in that. So for our wire bundles, we're going to call them wires in our HCLRS, or hardware programming language. So in this case, I'm giving the wire bundle a name called foo. And I'm declaring it as a bundle of 5 wires, a 5-bit wire bundle. And I'm specifying in various ways that it holds this value. And you might say, this is the initial value, right? No, this is what it's connected to. Yes, it looks like an assignment you might see in C, but this is what it's connected to. This is the only value it can hold because we can't only connect one thing to a wire physically. The same principle is going to hold true in our hardware programming language. So it's going to be always have this value. We can't assign another value. If we wanted to have a variable value, we shouldn't have assigned something that changes to it. Yes.
What's the 0b?
That indicates a binary constant. Okay. And I guess that's where I'll finish up today. So we'll continue more on sort of how we represent these simple calculations in HCLRS next time.